The following programming is sponsored by Amendment 16 Limited. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Hey, Ken Krawchuk here, and welcome to episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project. As you may know, here at the Pennsylvania Project, our vision is a better Pennsylvania. To achieve that vision, our mission is to boldly showcase the political, cultural, and environmental challenges facing contemporary Pennsylvania and to relentlessly pursue correct solutions. But more important than solving the problem correctly is to solve the correct problem, even if no one understands your solution. We have a laughable episode planned for today, and it's been laughable. And like all episodes of the Pennsylvania Project, it's divided into three parts. You, them, and me. Part one is all about you, your questions, your opinions, your solutions, your whatevers. And rather than a call-in format, we utilize an email-in format. So if you have something to say, you can always drop us a line at pennsylvaniaproject.com. Today for the you part, we have our latest regular feature, Unscripted Cohorts, where I get hit cold with a question from our cohort, except our cohort is not here today.
No,
we're out of it. Anyway, we also have We had half a question about college degrees, but that's not going to work either. So we go right to, I have a missing political commercial from my 2018 campaign for Pennsylvania governor, which we didn't have time to get in episode 136. After the you part comes part two, the them part, where each episode we host a guest to help showcase the political, cultural, and or environmental issues facing Pennsylvania. Today, our guest is all political. He's Paul Swalina, libertarian activist, author, and past school board director. After that comes the me portion of the Pennsylvania Project, where it will be my turn, your caster, Ken Krawchuk. I'll be focusing on some particular issue that really sticks in my craw. Today, I'm going to be ranting about objectivist humor. We'll see if anybody knows what that means. And throughout the show, as is our long-established custom, we'll be featuring a Pennsylvania Toastmaster to serve as narrator to read our live commercials. Today's narrator is making his second appearance on the Pennsylvania Project. He's Jeff Bernas, Vice President of Public Relations, I can speak, at LWD Toastmasters Club in Trenton. Welcome back to the Pennsylvania Project, Jeff.
Thank you, Ken. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, as you know, our cohort got lost on the way down, so she's not here today. So it looks like you're going to wind up doing double duty.
I'll give it my best.
Yeah. Because you're going to have to do, since you've been here before, you know what the routine is. Our cohort is somebody who joins in on the reading things out of our mailbag, which we don't have anything on our mailbag today, but joins in on discussions with our guests. So you'll be able to jump in on that and talk with our guest, Paul.
Okay, I welcome the challenge.
Yep. It shouldn't be a challenge. You know, it's a shame because I wanted to get our cohort to talk about a couple things. But we're going to just skip past all that. And ordinarily, we would go to listener question, but the listener question requires the presence of our cohort because it included her. So instead, I want to sneak something in that we didn't have time for last episode. Those who were listening last episode may recall that I was ranting about how several of the commercials from my past gubernatorial races, they highlighted solutions that are still being ignored today. We have six commercials in total, but last episode, we only had the time to run five of them. So I want to sneak in number six now, and I want to list it as the fifth most popular commercial from my 2018 race. It was the very first commercial we recorded for the race. This is back in 2017 we recorded it. It's called A Libertarian Moment, Pollution Solution. And the scene is me at a local park, standing in front of a waterfall. And yes, the waterfall makes a lot of noise, but the message is very clear. Ready? Here we go.
Hi, I'm Ken Krawchuk, libertarian candidate for Pennsylvania governor. Do you know what really sticks in my craw? Pollution. Air pollution, water pollution, noise pollution, light pollution, whatever kind of pollution. But under the policies of the two old parties, they'll even sell you the right to pollute. That's just plain wrong. Instead, what we should do is treat pollution as a trespass. That way, if somebody's junk is blowing, leaking onto your property, you have all the remedies available to you to fight trespassers at your disposal. That would mean police assistance, court orders, injunctions, whatever it takes to get them to clean up their mess. As governor, I would draw a clean line in the sand to fight pollution by treating it as a trespass. So please vote for me, Ken Krawchuk, Libertarian for Pennsylvania governor. Because if you keep voting the way you've been voting, you're going to keep on getting just what you've been getting, pollution and all.
And there you have it, the last of the commercials that I was planning to play last week. Thought I had it timed out. I'm a Toastmaster. You think I'd learn. But it's a solution that nobody's following. They actually have the right, you can buy the right to pollute.
Yes, I've seen that, of course. And it always did seem a bit useless.
Uh-huh. Well, it depends.
For lack of a better word.
I guess it depends what end of the stick you're on. For example, take Tesla. They are an electric car company. Right now, there are a lot of governments, especially in Europe, that will fine you if you do a certain amount of polluting. So what the old car companies do, the internal combustion engine car companies, is they will buy the right to pollute because there are certain credits that companies like Tesla get because they're not polluting, so they get credits. But they don't need the credits, so what they do is they sell them. And Tesla has been making hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter going back for the last several years by selling these credits to their competitors. And I think it's really ironic because right now Tesla is building a new factory in Germany. But that factory is being paid for by the German car manufacturers. So they're actually supporting the destroyer, which is something right out of Atlas Shrugged, right?
Yes. That's very well explained. I wasn't aware it was that.
Yeah. Because Tesla's not polluting, their cars aren't polluting, so they have all these credits and they sell them to other companies. And it drops right to their bottom line, hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter.
Now, that's, you know, I was wondering with the construction of the electric vehicle, of course, it's going to need to be charged.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you getting all that electricity from?
Well, right now you're getting it from the old grid, but one thing, I follow Elon Musk pretty closely. I mean, he's one of my modern-day heroes. But he has estimated that in order to power the entire United States, you would only need to take a square of solar cells out in the middle of the Texas desert, something like 100 miles square, and that would power the entire United States. And I don't know if you've ever been down to Texas, Paul, but it's just wasteland down there. There's nothing.
No, I haven't seen it. I've only flown over it.
Yep. And now, and this is going to sound like a Tesla commercial, but they have their Solar City branch. And what they're doing is they're putting solar panels on roofs, and they're also selling their power wall, which is a battery they put in the garage, which stores the energy. And the houses can go off the grid. In fact, they have so much energy that they can sell it back to the utilities. And just last week, Tesla was granted the status of an electric utility in Texas. You may recall that Texas had a big problem early this year because they had this cold snap and their grid broke down and everything. But what Elon is doing is he's putting solar panels on everybody's roofs. He gives them a battery, charge it up. And then if there's a blackout or something, he can actually turn it around the other way and tap into the batteries in people's houses, and they can sell the electricity back. So it's a distributed utility. There's no central plant. There's no place that burns coal or natural gas or anything like that. No hydroelectric plant or anything. It's just solar panels on your roof, charges up your battery, and you could sell the electricity out from there.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I've had about getting a solar panel on my roof is, do I get a battery?
Well, if you go
with
through
it, and it, the answer has been no so far.
Uh-huh.
From the places I've asked,
when you get it through Tesla, through their Solar City subsidiary, they require you to get the battery. So it's a package deal. You get one, you get the other. You know, and I talked to them. Oh, it had to be 2 years ago now. I was thinking of getting solar on the roof. But they guaranteed it. They said, well, put it on your roof, guarantee you for 20 years that your roof won't leak. And it's like, wait a minute, I have a 50-year roof. on my house. I'm going to put 20-year holes in a 50-year roof. You know, I don't think so. So we didn't do it. And it only saved me $5-$10 a month. Not a big deal.
Yeah, I'm in a position now where I was waiting till I got a new roof. And I finally did. And now I'm looking at it. Oh, it looks so good. Do I want to risk putting more leaks? Because I've had problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to risk putting more leaks in my roof over something that's going to save me
like
$10 or $20 a month?
Yeah.
I have a very low electric bill as it is.
Yeah, so do I, because we don't have central air in the house, and we just don't use a lot of electricity, you know? Our electric bill's got to be $20 or $30 a month. It's just not a lot.
Well, I do have a central air. And when I bought a new energy efficient unit, it's a very big unit, and it's not a big house.
Mm-hmm.
And the electric bill just dropped, and I don't know if I should just not be saying this on the air, because it could all be a mistake.
It's a mistake, right?
It's why is my electric bill so low now?
Uh-huh.
But okay.
Yeah, I actually follow up with stuff like that. I got a long story about that. But, you know, since we have the time, why don't we just go right to our guest? But first, that's going to have to do it for the you portion of episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project. So instead of going on, two of us, we're going to pause for this information. And when we return, we're going to be meeting with today's guest, Paul Svalina, Libertarian Party activist, author, and past school board director.
Did you hear the latest news? Almost two-thirds of all federal spending now goes to pay for the welfare state. More than $2.2 trillion, which just about equals federal income. Do you realize what that means? Virtually all tax revenue is now being consumed by the welfare state. But how do we rein in that runaway spending before it destroys America? The answer? The separation of society and state. That's the premise of the new novel, Atlas Snubbed, an unsanctioned parody sequel to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Snubbed presents a workable alternative to the welfare state as we know it. Atlas Snubbed expertly extends Rand's epic story of a looter's world snubbed by the men of the mind, bringing to life a crumbling post-apocalyptic world where no one need ask who is John Galt, because now they know. Atlas Snubbed. Available at all online bookstores or through atlassnubbed.com. Read it today before it's too late.
Okay, here's an interesting question. What do you think of these three ideas? Number one, people have at all times an inalienable right to alter, reform, or abolish their government as they think proper. Number two, juries shall have the right to determine the law as well as the facts. Number three, the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned. Do those words sound like they're something taken from a Hollywood political thriller? They're not. They're all direct quotes from Article 1 of the Pennsylvania Constitution. Everyone's heard of the United States Constitution, but have you even heard of the Pennsylvania Constitution? Have you ever read it? But most importantly, was it ever taught to you in school? If you're like virtually all Pennsylvanians, the answers are likely to be no, no, and no. Well, it's long past time we change those answers to yes, yes, and yes. And you have a crucial part to play in making that come to pass. As you know, we here at the Pennsylvania Project are all about solutions. So we've authored a petition demanding that the Pennsylvania Constitution be taught to our children. If you believe it's important for our children to know how our state government works, head over to our website, PennsylvaniaProject.com, and add your name to the growing list of signers. And every time we accumulate another batch of signatures, we'll send a copy of the petition to the governor, the Pennsylvania Board of Education, and each and every one of the 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, asking them right now to start teaching our children the Pennsylvania Constitution. So please sign the petition at PennsylvaniaProject.com. The alternative is yet another generation that has never heard of, let alone read, the Pennsylvania Constitution. And people wonder why no one votes anymore.
Too true. Hey, Ken Krawchuk here again, and welcome to the Them portion of episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project, where we like to host a guest to help showcase the political, cultural, and or environmental issues facing contemporary Pennsylvania. Today's guest is all political. He's Paul Spolina, libertarian activist and author and past school board director in the Wyoming Valley West School District up in the Wilkes-Barre area. He's also run for Congress in Luzerne County and calls himself a perennial candidate. I don't have a list of all his offices here. And not only is he a small business owner, he is also the author of the Dropping Stones trilogy and another novel enticingly named The Well of Depravity. In that spirit, welcome to the Pennsylvania Project, Paul.
Thank you so much, Ken. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. You know, it's good that you're there. I have to apologize for the delay, but our cohort ran into some car troubles. And yeah, so that's all right. Hey, we're Toastmasters.
It happens.
We can, yep. It happens. Yes, pronounce that correctly. You know, it's real funny. You got one over on me when you told me that your hometown, because I pride myself on knowing all the back roads of Pennsylvania and all the little towns, but I had never heard of Drums before. You know?
Yeah, Drums is also known as Butler Township. Uh-huh. And it's situated between Wilkes-Barre and Hazleton.
Well, you know, I looked on a map and I realized why it got away from me, because there's no interstates nearby. There's no numbered highways that go through it. And probably the biggest thing about it is it's right in the same neighborhood as Waverly. Waverly is a decent sized town, but that has no numbered roads through it either. I've been there.
That's up north. Yep.
Yeah, I like Waverly. It's a nice little town. It's a good place to hide.
It is.
I bet you probably hide up there too. Man, oh man. So, pretty country up there too. Really gorgeous, especially this time of year.
It is. We're blessed to live here.
Yep. School board director. Man, oh man. What made you want to become a school board director?
It was back in the early 90s. I served from 93 to 97. So I was a much younger man. And
I had my
sights set on a career in politics. So that was actually my second race. I ran for mayor of Kingston before that, and that was just to get my name out, and so I have some name recognition from the next race, mm-hmm. which was for a school director, and I was fortunate enough to win.
Wow. I've looked into running for school board, and I always felt that there's no flexibility in that. You know, you're really just a cog in the machinery, because what can you do? A lot of it's dictated by state law. The funding is dictated by what your property owners can afford. What did you get done? Mm-hmm. What did you do on the school board? What accomplishments did you have?
Well, I was named chairman of the negotiations committee, so I negotiated the teachers union contract, the administrator contract, and the support staff mm-hmm. contracts. A lot of people don't realize, when they think about a school board and, just cut 20%, just cut this, cut that. Most people don't realize that like 95% of a school district's budget is already set.
Yep.
It's 80 to 85% is teachers' salaries, benefits, and pension.
Yep.
Then you throw the administrators on top of that and support staff, utilities, simple maintenance, and your 90 to 95% of your budget is already set.
Yep.
If you're cutting something, you're cutting books, or you're cutting, activities or something, or band or whatever,
That's all there is to it. And Paul, that's what I meant when I said that you're really a cog when you're running for school board.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard some people have fun with the position. For example, you said you were on the negotiating staff there. One of the valid negotiating points is when you're talking to the teachers is to say no and just keep saying no.
Yeah, that was one of the issues that they had with me, because I made my position known when I was running, and it's an interesting story. I mean, this is you know, the days when you would think that in the 90s, even, you know, the old break their legs union mentality mm-hmm. would have gone by the wayside, but really it wasn't. The president of the teachers union at that time was caught on a recorded phone call, you know, threatening school board members. I mean, literally saying, this is all alleged, so let me, you know, but even the teachers, you know, admitted that it was him. But saying it's time to blow up the front porches of these school directors. And then he continued, like you would think, okay, well, that was just a joke. That was just, but then he continued the sentence with, seriously, really, it's time to break their legs.
What happened? Did the guy get thrown in jail or?
Nothing. Because they, obviously it's illegal to record a phone call without the person's knowledge. So
yep.
It was, you know, nobody would come forth and admit that, you know, they made the recording. So, you know, all a bunch of technicalities. So he skated, and not only did he skate, but at the next teachers union meeting, they all gave him a standing ovation and chanted his name.
Maybe they think that some legs needed to be broken too. I don't know.
Yeah. So they all want to say, oh no, we don't condone that, but their actions speak louder than words.
That's pretty bad. You know,
it was.
And people ask me,
and I had young children at the time. I was just, when I got elected, I had my first daughter and I had two more while I was serving. And, you know, that's, you know, I mean, they broke into my car.
Wow.
They had me followed. During one of the negotiation sessions, they slashed the tires of our business manager. So, yeah, it was, you know, some nasty stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, I was going to add in a story there of my own when I first ran for politics, because I didn't want to do it because, you know, I thought, oh, man, I'm going to be getting threatening phone calls and slashed tires. That's exactly what I was what I was afraid of. But the first anonymous phone call I got, it went the other way. It's some lady, and she says, listen, you should be down at Alverthorpe Park because your opponent is shaking hands, and you should be down there shaking hands too. And I said, who is this? And she says, that doesn't matter. What's important is you get down to the park right away and start shaking hands. So I had all these clandestine supporters all behind the scenes. And, you know,
good.
Paul, I expected to find just what the kind of things that you're talking about, all these black-hearted people threatening to bombing your porch and everything like that. But I found that the people in politics, at least in Abington Township, they care very deeply for the community. It's the same thing with our police force. You know, they're straight up, honest, straightforward people. Now, a lot of times the politicians don't know what to do. They're doing exactly the wrong thing. But their hearts are in the right place. And I was surprised to learn that. And I've seen that, and I've been in politics. That was back in 94, back at the same time you were in there. And I've run for governor 3 times. I've been all over the state. I've run for state representative 2 times, my town council 4 times. And I found nothing but good people. Nothing but good people. You know, so I'm really surprised. So now we got.
Well, that's good. You've had a good experience, yeah.
I know. So now we got listeners saying, all right, who's right? Is it going to be somebody bombing my porch, or is it going to be somebody giving me an anonymous phone call?
Well, it could just as have been that particular union leader, but I don't know. I'm not convinced that it's in their past.
Now you're out there. That's, you know, Northeast Pennsylvania. That's pretty middle of nowhere, except for the, you know, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area. They're the only really big cities up that way. I guess Hazleton too, but Hazleton's not that big. But what's the general economic activity up there? I mean, what do people do? They all work at 7-Eleven and Wawa's or what?
We do have some good manufacturing base up here. We have a lot of distribution centers, so that's a lot of. We have some very solid industrial parks up here, so we're very close to the intersection of 80 and 81.
Yep.
So. you know, I'm actually just 2 miles from that intersection.
Uh-huh.
So you have, you know, so, you know, distribution is key. And you have access to two of the biggest highways in the country. So,
yeah, a north-south and an east-west interstate crossing the country both directions.
Yep. So that has, you know, played a role here. And, you know, it's taken a long time because, you know, we were the king of coal back in the day,
you know,
back in the 40s and 50s.
Yep.
So when coal was king, I mean, Stratton was a major city.
Yep.
You know, back then.
You go past it now, their whole neighborhoods are almost deserted, you know?
Yeah.
I was up there at what's called Van Noy Park, I think it's called,
mm-hmm.
and there was a big cannabis fest up there. But when we were driving through, you know, we were checking out the rest of the town, and it's just, it's amazing, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
poor doesn't describe it.
Yeah, well, there's been a, you know, flight out of cities everywhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Certainly could be. Now, let's shift gears a little bit, because you've run for all sorts of things. And like I said, I didn't have the full list, but I was looking at your Congress race. You're very mm-hmm. prolific out on social media. You got a lot of stuff that you've written out there.
So, uh-oh.
The internet never forgets, right? So, when you were running for Congress, what were your big planks?
Well, one major plank was I was tired of, you know, puppets being sent to Washington. Like, no matter which, you know, Democrat or Republican get there, I mean, there's no independent voice. I mean, everybody thinks there's 435 Congress people. There's only two.
Huh.
There's a Speaker of the House and there's a House the Minority Leader. And that's it.
Uh-huh.
You fall in line with those two. So anybody who thinks there's like any independent thinking going on in the House of Representatives is just delusional.
Mm-hmm. I would tend to,
the threats come down. You get in line, or we're going to primary you, or you will not get any of the pork. You will not be part of any committee. You will fall in line. So there's, you know, when you think about it, there really is only two people in Congress: the Speaker of the House and the House Minority Leader.
Now, have you run for Pennsylvania office besides school board?
No, Luzerne County Council this past year.
Uh huh.
But the the ballot access is always an issue. I mean, we had to get 571 signatures.
You're going to get my blood boiling with that, because Pennsylvania's ballot access laws are antiquated.
Oh, absolutely, they need to change.
When I was running for governor back in 2002. Ed Rendell needed 2,000 signatures to get on the ballot. Mike Fisher needed 2,000 signatures. I needed 21,027, more than 10 times as many. Yeah.
I mean, for my race for county council, you know, Republicans were required to get 250, Democrats 250.
Yeah.
But me, 571. Now what?
Ooh, more than twice as much. And, you know,
it's arbitrary.
Uh-huh. No, it's worse than arbitrary. It was a judge who made up that rule. It's the number of signatures is 2% of the highest vote getter in that district in the prior election.
Correct.
And
yep.
It was a judge sitting on the bench, legislating from the bench, who came up with that. And I could be wrong, but I think it was Ed Rendell's wife, Marjorie, who was the person who did it. And this is back in the late 80s, early 90s, long time ago.
Color me surprised.
Yeah. But, you know, we did win a big court case in 2016 against, the Democrats and Republicans had gotten together and they were challenging everybody. So what we mm-hmm. did is we put up a fight against the signature requirements, saying, you know, why should we get 20,000 when they only need to get 2,000? And this is the third time that I was a plaintiff on that sort of a lawsuit. One went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and they said, no, it's okay. The state has an interest in preventing ballot clutter. It's like, oh, I guess, you know, you only need two. But in 2016, we finally won one. And again, another judge legislating from the bench said, he said 5,000. He says, you need 5,000 signatures. It's like, wait a minute. The Pennsylvania Constitution, which I have here at my elbow, says all elections shall be equal. You know, they need 2,000. We should need 2,000. The judge is like, 5,000. That's it. We're like, oh, okay, 5,000 is better. But the big thing that they pulled back were the fines, because they could fine somebody if you tried to get on the ballot and lost. In fact, I ran in 2002. The next big statewide race was in 2004. They kicked Ralph Nader off the ballot, and they fined him $80,000 for having the temerity to try to get on to run for president. And then it was in And then 2006, that was Carl Romanelli, a green guy. He's just a retired guy from the Reading area. And they kicked him off the ballot and then fined him $80,000. And he still has an $80,000 judgment against him. Here it is, what, 15 years later? I know.
Yeah. That's like I said, it's borderline criminal.
It is. And I'm dying to talk about stuff because I'm a member of the Pennsylvania Ballot Access Coalition, and we're getting ready to introduce new legislation, and I can't talk about it yet.
No. Well, I look forward to hearing about it.
Yeah. Hey, I'm your caster, Ken Krawchuk, and you're listening to episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project. We'll be right back after this information with more from our libertarian activist, author, and past school board director, Paul Spallina.
Are you a small business owner always looking for referrals? Do you have a streamlined approach to generating new referrals? Contact Stephen Worley to learn the fast, easy way to generate new referrals. Stephen has an all-inclusive system that will help you generate an extra 5 to 10 customers per week without spending a single dollar on ads. You won't have to create a website, have pictures taken, or write a single ad. Stephen will take the headache out of the process. Contact him at stephenwerley.com. That's Stephen with a V, W-E-R-L-E-Y.com.
Hey, Ken Krawchuk here, caster for the Pennsylvania Project. You know, it's easy to find a high-paying job. At least for some people it is. Employers are begging for competent leaders who know how to communicate effectively. But do those words describe you? Competent leader communicates effectively? If not, or even if they do, you may want to consider joining Toastmasters. The mission of Toastmasters is to provide a supportive environment for learning communication and leadership skills. But does it really work? Hey, look at me. I joined Toastmasters, and now I've got my own radio show. So turn your life around like I have. Visit Toastmasters.org and contact a club near you. Visitors are always welcome, and be sure to mention that you heard it on the Pennsylvania Project radio show. The future is anxiously awaiting competent leaders who know how to communicate effectively. You can be that leader. It all starts at Toastmasters.org.
Philly Standard is a brand new beer from Yards Brewing Company that's crafted for every occasion. Philly Standard is brewed with 4 high-quality American ingredients. Hops, malt, yeast, and water. It's clean and very easy to drink, yet full-flavored at 4.5% ABV. Brewed for those times when you just want a beer, no bells, no whistles, just a damn good, no-nonsense beer. Philly Standard. Work hard, drink easy. Courtesy of Yards Brewing Company.
And Jeff, the last time you were here, we had Tom Kehoe, the president of Yards.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and he brought his own beer and everything. We should invite him back. He's been here twice now.
I think we should.
I think we should, too.
And make sure I'm here.
Yeah, me too. Hey, Ken Krawchuk here, and welcome to we're back with episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project, and our guest, Paul Spallina, libertarian activist, author, and past school board director. Paul, you know, I want to get into the author side because I'm an author. I've written several books, and I took a look at yours. You got four of them out there on Amazon, and they're heavy-duty political. Your trilogy there, it's a
political backdrop. Yeah.
Dropping Stones. What prompted that?
It was a story I had in my mind for a long time. I actually thought it was going to be just a short story that I would write.
Uh-huh.
And because I didn't have confidence that I could actually complete a novel. And then, I was online and connected with an old friend from elementary school. Haven't seen her in years, and I saw that she had written two books. So we started talking, and I got her books and read them. And she just encouraged me. She said, you know, if you feel you can write, you know, you should, you know, just sit down and write the story. And that's just what I did, you know, I just started writing, and it just came. It flowed pretty quickly for me.
Huh. Well, you know, that's what it takes. You just got to get up and start doing things. Cause,
right, exactly. Especially with writing. I mean, just put something on the paper.
Uh-huh.
Just get something on the paper, and it'll spark something, and you'll roll. And it doesn't matter if it's good or not. You're going to go back through it 100 times.
Yeah.
You can improve it, but just get something on the paper so you have the act of typing and having words to read.
Uh-huh.
You know?
It's the same thing. You get that story in you. There's some kicker that you got in the back of your mind, and that's how I got started with Atlas Snubbed, because Ayn Rand and her Atlas Shrugged book, she made several mistakes in there. I'm a very big believer in her books. I like her books a lot. In fact, my rant is going to touch on Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. But I always read it after each of my big races, read Atlas Shrugged, just to do a level set. But when I finished it, have you read Atlas Shrugged?
I haven't.
You haven't. At the end of it, the United States is crumbling. There's fighting in the streets. People are dying by the millions, starvation and everything like that. And it's a great post-apocalyptic point, but it stops right there. It's like, oh, man, there should be more after this. And Ayn Rand made several mistakes in her book. And I was complaining to my wife. I said, somebody ought to write a sequel to that. And she had one of those moments, you know, these moment of truth moments. She says, why don't you do it? Mm-hmm. And we were driving up to central New York at the time. And by the time we got to where we were going, I already had the whole plot laid out and everything like that. And got home and I just started writing it. And it's out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Good.
Likewise. Now, did you self-publish?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Which one did you go through? Commercial here, commercial.
Through Amazon. This Amazon.
Uh-huh. Because I started with Lulu. This is back in, I guess, 2010 when I was publishing.
I'm familiar with them,
yeah. But Amazon hadn't yet hit the mainstream yet. And Lulu was it worked, but it was expensive. It was a little bit clunky. And when Amazon came in, it was just like, wow, man, this is easy. So if anybody has the great American novel hiding inside of them, now is the time. It's just easy to do.
Oh, yeah. I always encourage people. Absolutely. This is, and I couldn't believe when I finished it, did some self-editing and you just, you upload a PDF and you click publish. And that's you're done. I mean, you had to get a cover and design a cover and everything, but, and that's it. And you're on Amazon, you know?
Yep. I actually had two editors on my books. Two for Atlas Snubbed, because that book was big. The director's cut version is 700 pages. The regular version is about 400 pages. Yeah, I was peddling it to different literary agents, and they all said the same thing. They said, come on, Ken, nobody reads 700-page novels. I was like, hey, they read Atlas Shrugged, right? And that's 1,200 pages. and that was my target audience. But they said, no, cut it in half. So I did. So I got two versions now, a regular and a director's cut.
Oh, okay.
And I have other ones.
I will have to check it out.
Yep. I got one that's more fun. It's not nearly as big. It's called No Dogs on Mars. It's about it's about SpaceX starships during the days of colonizing Mars. And I'm not going to tell you anything about it because there's a surprise ending to it. Pretty surprise.
Ah, okay.
Yep.
I'll find out for myself.
Yes. Now, you have the fourth book, which you say is distinctly different from all the others, The Well of Depravity. I didn't read much of it. I read the description. It sounds like a horror story.
It's a psychological suspense, yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And told through the eyes of a serial killer.
Uh-huh.
So when the people who were buying my first three books, and the second and third are heavily Christian. So when I wrote the fourth book, I mean, I had to put, you know, I sent anybody buying this fourth book, I just want to let you know, this is like completely different than the first three. I mean, you just have to be prepared for that. And you know, many of the same people who read the trilogy read The Well with Depravity, and you know, some didn't finish because they, you know, just wasn't their thing. But the ones who did, you know, were very complimentary, and they understood, you know, they weren't that, you know. And I try to write, you know, clean, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not it's overtly.
It's the same thing with me, because I wanted my mother to read the book, you know.
Right, right.
That kind of put lines around things. And while there a few people do manage to get together, it's done, I think it's done tastefully. But that's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll wait, because Jeff has a copy of my book. He hasn't finished reading it yet.
So, okay. That's right. I love the introduction.
He just got it.
Well, the first couple of chapters I've read. But
yep.
After the introduction, I thought, ooh, this is for me.
There you go. An unpaid testimonial there. Let's see. I'm looking down my list of other things here. I guess that's probably it. And, you know, I'm looking at the time anyway. We're just about out of time. And, you know, Paul, one thing I always like to do is to open up the mic for our guests to talk about anything they want for a minute, you know, 30 seconds, something like that. And we've had people go all over the map. One guy talked about the evils of puppy mills, another guy about the importance of breast cancer research. And about four or five episodes ago, we had a guy who set the bar really high. He read some Cicero on the air, and it was about right after.
Well, I am not gonna. I'm not jumping over that bar. I'm gonna promise you that.
So anyway, we got about 2.5 million people under the footprint here of the radio station. Paul, what do they need to know?
Oh, they need to know to start thinking independently.
Mm-hmm.
Turn off the television. Start doing your own news gathering and research, and recognize what is going on, you know, around you. Starting with public education, government education. I know you heard that
yes.
term.
Thank you.
You know, this is probably the worst model possible for educating children. And yet we continue to pour billions and billions into this. And it's a failed model. We spend more per child on government education than any other country.
Hmm.
And do we think the results are better? No.
No.
They're not. We need people to start homeschooling, private school, charter schools, community pods. Public government education. And I think this has hit critical mass here, that people are recognizing that it's less about education, more about indoctrination.
Yep.
You can't take 25 to 30 kids, put them in a class, all each of them with a different learning style, and expect the best results. We are wasting the talents of so many great teachers. These teachers should be on their own, charging whatever they want for a group of 10 students who have a similar learning style,
mm-hmm.
or however it can work. That there's so many different models that can work.
I agree.
But this reflexive action into you have to fund public schools and you have to, public education is the best way to do it. It is not. Homeschooling is always the best. You have a parent and a child who knows that child better than anybody.
Yep, I agree. You know,
failing that. Private school, charter school. There's so many better options, and we continue to just mindlessly march into these government schools and pour billions and billions of dollars into a failed model.
Yep.
And no end in sight.
True. And, you know, there is end in sight. I'm looking at the clock here. So
thanks. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, that's good, Paul. Your message is excellent. That's why I let you go on and on. But that is going to have to wrap it up for the them portion of episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Paul Swalina, our libertarian activist, author, past school board director, and he knows what he's talking about when it comes to the educational system. We're going to pause for this information.
Thank you so much, Ken. Great to be here.
You're welcome, sir. Some other time, too. We're going to have to pause for this information. And when we return, I'm going to be ranting about objectivist humor.
The following is a commercial announcement.
Hey, Jeff, how's it going?
Bad, Ken. Really bad.
Why? What's the matter?
Our friends at the Infernal Revenue Service paid me a personal visit the other day.
Infernal Revenue Service?
Yep. Call them what they are. They sent these two big brutes to my house, scared us all half to death.
I bet. What do they want?
Money. Of course. Lots of it. Remember that part-time gig I had last summer?
Oh, yeah. You were raking in some big bucks.
Yeah, and all those big bucks went straight into my personal bank account. Turns out the IRS doesn't like that, and I didn't file any of the right forms or pay nearly enough in taxes, so they want it all. Now. Right now. Plus penalties and interest.
Ouch. It sounds like you should have called Amendment 16.
Hey, it's the damn 16th Amendment that got me into this predicament in the first place.
No. Amendment 16, the invoicing service. They'll invoice your client for the hours and expenses you report to them, and when your client pays them, they pay you, minus all required state and federal taxes. It's that easy. One call does it all. And they'll even have an accountant do your personal taxes for you come April Fool's Day. Come April 15th.
And they take care of all the taxes? All the forms?
Yep, and they can pass along certain tax breaks, too.
Man, I wish I knew about Amendment 16 sooner. Where can I find them?
On the web, of course, at amendment16.com, with 16 spelled out. That's Amendment, SIXTEEN.com. One call does it all. Hey, Ken Krawchuk here, and welcome to the me portion of episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project, where I get to rant a bit about something that really sticks in my craw. Today, it's objectivist humor. And yes, that does sound pretty oxymoronic, doesn't it? And for those who don't know, an objectivist is someone who objects to everything. No, I'm kidding. It only seems that way. Actually, an objectivist is an adherent of objectivism, which is a philosophy defined by the 20th century Russian philosopher Ayn Rand, and is best laid out in her novel Atlas Shrugged, one of the biggest novels there is. Rand defined objectivism as being, quote, "The concept of man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute." Unquote. But in my mind, that could be better summed up with just four words, which happen to be the title of one of her books, The Virtue of Selfishness. And if you don't believe that selfishness is a virtue, or for that matter, if you don't believe every single thing that Ayn Rand has ever said, written, or implied, then you, ladies and gentlemen, are irredeemably evil and should be shunned or worse. Now, this should give you an idea of why objectivists might stick in my craw. You know, one of our cohorts here on the Pennsylvania Project, Ed Metz, he tells a joke that has several variants. His version starts off, "How can you tell if someone is a pilot?" And his answer? "Talk to them for 10 minutes. Well, I found out 10 minutes after meeting Ed that he is a pilot. The other variant of the joke that I've heard recently was, "How can you tell a vegan?" Except you only have to talk to them for 5 minutes before you find out. Same group, same idea. Well, I was thinking there should be an objectivist version. How can you tell if somebody is an objectivist? They will immediately launch into a long, drawn-out speech about how evil you are. And I've seen it time and time and time again. Nah, I'm joking. Sort of. Kind of. But seriously, it seems to me that objectivists have absolutely no sense of humor. And that's just not just my opinion, because I went out to the internet and I Googled objectivist humor. And virtually every single hit was humor about objectivism, not objectivist humor, if you understand the subtlety of difference. Now, here's probably the best of them. This one came from John Rogers, a 2009 blog called Kung Fu Monkey. He had this objectivist joke, and I quote, "There are two novels that can change a bookish 14-year-old's life forever, The Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. One of them is a childish fantasy that often engenders a lifelong obsession with its unbelievable heroes, leading to an emotionally stunted, socially crippled adulthood unable to deal with the real world. And the other book, of course, involves orcs. Now that is funny. But you see, that's humor about objectivism, not objectivist humor. But I kept looking, I persevered, and in my searches, I finally found, literally, two hits that could be considered objectivist humor. Only two. One of them was a classic setup from upjoke.com. The question is, how many objectivists does it change to take a light bulb? The answer is, well, you just shrug. That's bad. That's bad. See what I mean? No sense of humor. I did find the other one, but it was a real dad joke, if you know what I mean. It's from ergosum.wordpress.com, and it goes like this. Ayn Rand, you got to help me. I've lost my car keys. My wife says they're somewhere in our house, but my son says they're not. Who should I believe? And Ayn Rand replies, check your premises, and you will find that one of them is wrong. You have to be an objectivist to understand that. Ayn Rand is always saying, check your premises, check your premises. Ba-da-bump. As I said, no sense of humor. Nothing's funny. If anybody has an objectivist joke, let me know. Well, you know, someone once asked Rand to define humor. And in her typical objectivist style, her reply was a long, drawn-out speech. No lie. I'm not going to read it verbatim. There's not enough time left in the day to do that. But let me sum it up for you as best can be done by a non-objectivist, meaning me. And I hope I didn't lose its meaning. So here's the Reader's Digest version, I guess the Cliff Notes version. Quote, humor is the denial of metaphysical importance to that which you laugh at. You got it? Humor is the denial of metaphysical importance to that which you laugh at. Let me rephrase that, but without using a preposition to end a sentence with. She is saying that if you laugh at something, you are denying its metaphysical importance. Yeah. And here I thought you laughed at something because it was funny. Not to an objectivist, apparently. Now you see why I'm ranting about objectivist humor. It's just, I don't see it. And she has a little bit more in that long speech of hers. She says, quote, humor is a destructive element, which is quite all right, unquote. Yeah, right. That's why in her novel, Atlas Shrugged, it's quite all right that her hero, John Galt, destroys the world. And I guess it's funny, too. At least an objectivist, it'd be funny. I don't know. And Rand also said that something would be truly funny, but if only she weren't being dead serious about it. Here's how she defined truly funny. If what you are laughing at is the evil in the world, that's fine. Really? If what you are laughing at is the evil of the world is fine? Does that mean it's okay to laugh at the Holocaust or laugh at war and destruction or death and famine or okay to laugh at Governor Big Bad Wolf and his unconstitutional lockdowns? I don't know. Go figure. Objectivist humor. And, you know, in support of that outrageous proposition, in true objectivist fashion, Rand makes her comparison even longer by looking at it from the other side. And she says, quote, to laugh at that which is good, to laugh at heroes, at their values, that is monstrous. So you're allowed to laugh at bad things, but you're not allowed to laugh at good things? It's pretty blunt, don't you think? But hey, that's objectivism. And in case you didn't quite get the gist of all of that, she sums up her long rant with her opinion of humor quite nicely in its final sentence. Ready? Quote, the worst evil that you can do psychologically is to laugh at yourself. That would mean spitting in your own face, unquote. So she's saying an objectivist wouldn't laugh if they hit themselves in the face with a pie? I guess not. I think that would be funny. Shows what I think about metaphysical importance here, don't you? I'm telling you, folks, you cannot make this stuff up. If humor is the denial of importance, then I guess it means that an objectivist would find it funny not to send me hate mail about my rant today. Well, that's going to happen or not. I don't know. We'll see. Now, hang on. I don't want you to think that I'm all down, all over Rand, because I like Ayn Rand. I like her books. I've read most everything she's ever written, all her novels, plays, essays, everything. And personally, I think Atlas Shrugged is the best book ever written. But in all of that reading, all these different things I've read, I can only recall two places where one of her heroes laughed. One is the opening line from her novel, The Fountainhead. It is, and I quote, "Howard Roark laughed," unquote. Why does he laugh, I hear you ask? Obviously, he's denying the metaphysical importance to that which he laughed at. What else would it be, right? And what was he laughing at? He just got expelled from college. Hey, I'd laugh too if I just got expelled from college. That's because I hated college, to a degree, that is. The only other time one of her heroes laughs is in Atlas Shrugged. John Galt himself, quote unquote, burst out laughing when the American head of state offers Galt the job of economic dictator. I guess Galt was denying the importance of being an economic dictator. I don't know. But it doesn't make sense that he'd think it funny, because a couple paragraphs later, he starts off giving those dictatorial orders. Things like abolish all income taxes, fire your government employees, and all sorts of other anarchistic things. And then after giving all those orders, contradictorily, he says, "I don't want to be economic dictator." Pardon me, ladies and gentlemen, I just don't get it. I don't see the humor in it, and I don't understand how humor can be the denial of metaphysical importance to that which you don't laugh at. Excuse me, which you do laugh at. I probably couldn't even say that five times fast. I can't say it one time fast, let alone laugh at it. But then I'm not an objectivist. I'm a libertarian. And Rand, she didn't like libertarians. She once called us Republicans who smoke pot. And to me, that is funny because I have never been a Republican. On that high note, that's going to have to wrap it up for episode 137 of the Pennsylvania Project. What do you think about quote unquote objectivist humor? Or our libertarian activist Paul Swalina? Or the necessity of a college degree or anything Pennsylvania related? If you have something to say, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us at PennsylvaniaProject.com right after you sign our petition, that is. And you can hear us there too, as well as on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and a plethora of other popular podcast providers. Today's episode is courtesy of Amendment 16 Limited and produced live at the studios of WWDB Radio, broadcasting in Philadelphia at 860 on the AM dial every Monday at 3 p.m., among other times. And now on WPEN 97.5 FM HD2 in Burlington, New Jersey. Each episode is also released as a podcast every Monday at PennsylvaniaProject.com. Our webmaster is Stephen Worley. Our featured Toastmaster narrator is Jeff Bernas. Official bartender is Tom Kehoe. Keyboard wizard Joe the Pag. Radio producer Brett Kronberger. Executive producer Mark Bazzacco. And me, your caster, Ken Krawchuk. Thanks for joining us. And remember, more important than solving the problem correctly is to solve the correct problem, even if no one thinks it's funny.